Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom. Lametet Amud Bet. Here, the Gemara here is going to bring a numerous memrot from Rav Amar Rav Nachman. As the Rashbam points out, they could have consolidated all of them into one memra. It's just that Rav heard them from Rav Nachman at different times, and they're just consolidating and bringing them together in a single memra. And that's why each one of them is noted independently. In addition to that, you have to discuss in each case, why is it that the Gemara brought down the two aspects that are going to be mentioned in each case? What's the chiddush? Why would we have thought otherwise? So obviously related to our Gemara is, Amar Rav, Amar Rav Nachman, micha'ah. Person who wants to object to someone possessing their land or being in their land. Bifnei shnayim. It has to be done in front of two edim. Ve'ein tzarich lomar tovu. And you don't have to write, or you don't have to tell the edim to document that which he said. If they go ahead and document it without his permission or without his knowledge, that is fine. So the Rashbam notes over here, the documentation is a schut. It's to his benefit. And we have a principle in general is, Zachim she'adam shelo bifanav. You can merit or you can benefit another party even when he's not there or even without his acquiescence because it's to his benefit. And therefore we assume that he would of course want it. And given that, you can act on his behalf to do something that's to his benefit. And so over here, the ktiva is to his benefit. Since it's to his benefit, you're allowed to document it even without his permission. Now, micha'ah bifnei shnayim, the fact that you have to do it in front of two, the chiddush there, according to the Rashbam, is two and not three. Which is that we just had a machloket in the previous amud. Does micha'ah require three? Or does micha'ah require two? It has to be done in front of edim. Or does it have to be done in front of three, which was a gilui milta? Over here, Rav Amar Rav Nachman saying that, bifnei shnayim, two is enough, and you do not need the three. That'd be the simplest way to understand it, is that this is being machriya between the two positions that we had before, and saying two rather than three. So over here, there's a lot of complexity to what's being said, and it applies to the cases afterwards as well. Which is, number one, in terms of the bifnei shnayim, whenever you have something that has to be done in front of two, there can be different reasons for that fact. Edim can act in one of two manners. Edim can be what we call edei raya, which is that they are just there to verify that which happened. If we, after the fact, want to know what happened, the edim can come and tell us what happened. But sometimes edim have to be there in order to be what's called edei kiyum. The edim themselves are what make whatever you've done into a fact, or they give it legal standing because there are two edim that are there. So for instance, the case where most people say that is by kiddushin. We have two edim by kiddushin. It's not that we need the two edim there in order to later verify that you got married, because kiddushin wouldn't work if there weren't two edim there. Kiddushin only work if the two edim are present. So why does it have to do with the raya? If it's all about raya, then edim should have no impact on whether the kiddushin is chal or the kiddushin is not chal. The reason the kiddushin is chal is because there are two edim there. Without the two edim, you don't have kiddushin. What that tells you is that the edim are edei kiyum. They're the ones that give legal standing to the fact that there was a kiddushin. So you have to ask that same question in all of these instances here. The number of items that the Gemara is going to bring, when it says bifnei shnayim, why is there a requirement for two? Is the requirement for two simply an issue of raya? That if you want to have a proof to the fact that you actually did this, you want to have evidence of the fact that you did it, you need two? Or is the bifnei shnayim over here telling you that you need these edim in order to give it tokef, in order to give this legal standing, you need two edim because they are edei kiyum? So truthfully, in all of these cases, there are machloket rishonim about whether the two edim are absolutely necessary or whether the two edim are what we call edei kiyum. The Raivad in almost all the cases here says that the two edim are edei kiyum, and that they're what give legal standing to that which happens. Majority of Rishonim, especially the Ramban, in most of these cases, thinks that the Edim here are l'ra'ya, are simply there for the proof, or the fact that, evidence of the fact that something happened. But if you object in front of the party, and he admits the fact that you objected, that would be an objection. You don't need the two Edim to give tokef, to give legal standing to your objection. You need the two Edim to prove that you did it. If there's nobody else there, you can't claim an objection when there was nobody there. You need evidence to that fact. Well, the evidence can come in the way of edim, or evidence can come in the way of an admission from the other party that there was an objection. But not that the two edim are absolutely necessary to generate the objection. The other thing is, in terms of ein tzarich lomar ktovu, that you don't have to tell them to write it down, the Balei Tosafot raise an interesting issue over here, which is, why are you allowed to write it down? When we say you're allowed to write or document something, is when it is to the benefit of this party, but not to the detriment of another party. That's when there are two parties involved, then as long as it's to the benefit of one party and neutral to the other party, that's fine. But if it's to the detriment of the other party, you can't document something unilaterally in favor of one party, and then it hurts the other party. So for instance, you have a loan that was granted. You have a creditor and you have a debtor. The creditor does not have a right to draw up a document and have the sofer write it for him and have Edim sign on the document. Because he's unilaterally now, even though it's to his benefit, he's unilaterally now creating something that's detrimental to the debtor. The other way around, the debtor can have a document drawn up and signed on his behest, even though the creditor is not there, because for the creditor, it's only to his benefit. For the debtor, it's his detriment, but he's the one asking us to do it. So in that case, you can do it. In that case, you're permitted to write unilaterally for that party. Over here, you have a problem. When you have the machad, the objection that has been made, what right do you have to document that? It's to the benefit of the party who's objecting, but it's to the detriment of the party who is in the land now, the one who claims that he bought it. The objection will hurt his standing. So what right do you have to create a document that is to the detriment of the other party? In addition to that, the Balei Tosafot ask over here, don't we have a principle? Testimony has to be presented verbally or orally to the Beit Din. The Gemara darshins al pi shnayim edim, pi shlosha edim, that says, mi pihem v'lo mi pi ktavam. That you have to hear the testimony directly from the edim themselves. Can't be hearsay, can't be aid mi pi aid, but also can't be mitocha ktav. You can't write your testimony into Beit Din. Can't give an affidavit. You have to actually testify in Beit Din. Over here, you're doing exactly that. You are documenting edut. You're documenting something that you witnessed, and then they're going to use that as a proof for the fact that something transpired. So what right do you have to document your edut, to document your testimony, which is what we would want you for over here, is to testify to the fact that this incident or this objection took place. So what right do you have to document it and then have your edut be presented in a written form? Those are the two questions that the Balei Tosafot have over here. I have two basic problems what's happening. One is you're documenting something that is to the detriment of another party. Unilaterally, you're doing this. And number two is you're testifying through writing instead of through a verbal transmission of your testimony to Beit Din. So he says, V'yesh lomar, you have to answer the takanat chachamim hi. That there is a takanat chachamim sheichashuv edut kedei levatel hachazaka be'edut kolduhu. Shedover muat mivatlim chazaka. Remember, on the other side, or the party on the other side, is trying to establish a chazaka. A chazaka assumes or presumes that being there for a certain period of time grants you rights. A chazaka is not absolutely the case. It just says that in the majority, or generally in these situations, when we have such, that's an indication of ownership. So here you have a chazaka. You don't have something that's absolute, or something that says that airtight type of claim over here. You have something which is established by what are the norms. Therefore, Chazal allowed those norms to be upended or overturned with very minor objections. So that minor objection can go against the usual principles that we have of Edut. And that means that you can, number one, document it, even though it's the detriment of the other party. And number two is that you can do it in writing, even though normally you would require Edut verbally. So Devar Madli Chazaka, Da Afilu Yidbayer Lanu Shalosh Shema Machzik Mecha'a Mahani Devatel Chazaka. Tosu points out, I'll show you that that's true, because even if the individuals in the property never heard about the Mecha'a, even though we presume that he will hear about it because of the transmission of information, nevertheless, the Mecha'a works, the objection works. So you see here that the standard or threshold for a Mecha'a is very low. And given that, we don't require all the normal protocols or all the normal trappings of a dut or a Beit Din because of the fact that we've lowered the standard here in order to give, in essence, protections to the seller of a property or the supposed seller of the property here. Remember, the chazaka is to the benefit of the buyer. to say after 3 years he doesn't have to show a shtar anymore. That's a pretty big deal that he doesn't have to show a shtar. Because then if he's there for 3 years and he makes a claim, there's no way to undermine his position because he doesn't have to show evidence of the fact that there was a sale. How do we protect the supposed seller, original owner of the land? We give him the right to mechah. But we gave the right to mechah by lowering the standards of what you require in order to object. Any small objection will undermine that chazakah. That is the way that the Baalei Tosafot deal with it. Then he brings a very famous chiddush of the Rabbeinu Tam, which is a very controversial position. A lot of Rishonim don't agree with this Rabbeinu Tam, but obviously has major implications, especially the way that the court systems work today. It has major implications, which is V'od Omeri Sheshamami Rabbeinu Tam Shnoagim Lishloach Eidim Edut Beigeret LeBeitin. Eidim are allowed to send their testimony through a letter to Beit Din, or in other words, an affidavit. V'chashiv Edut, and that is considered to be full-fledged testimony. V'hada Darshina B'Sifrei. What about the fact that the Midrash Halacha says in Dvarim, Mipihem, Velo Mipiktavam, that has to be verbally or orally transmitted to the Beit Din and not in writing. Lo'at elimute davka ilayim, she'enu bar hagada. Comes to exclude someone who doesn't have the capacity to speak. They can't use it as an alternate writing to communicate their testimony. Aval ra'oi la'gada, anybody who could testify, who has the potential to testify, ein ha'gada me'akevet bo. Then that testimony in writing does not upend or undermine the requirement for verbal testimony. Or in other words, it's a principle in Shas in many places. Kol she yesh bo bila, ein bila me'akevet bo. If you have the potential to be mixed, then not mixing it won't affect it. So to over here, as long as you have the potential to verbally communicate in Beit Din, then sending an affidavit is a fine way to deal with the situation. It's a huge, huge chiddush Rabbeinu Tam, because now you have a possibility of writing in your testimony, even though it seems like the psukim are saying just the opposite, that you can't write in testimony. Rabbeinu Tam permits it. Tosfot then discusses other parts of that chiddush of Rabbeinu Tam, and then afterwards, in the end, he says, Vim Tomar, Mai Kamash Malan. What is this memra telling us? Dein Sarech Lamar Tovu, that they don't have to tell him to write it down? Pshita, Kevin Dischutohu, Obe Mecha, Ikalamemar Denakit Bey, Ein Sarech Lamar Tovu. If you allow for this type of testimony, if you allow this to happen, then why is it that he shouldn't write it down? Why shouldn't you document it? It's all to his benefit. So he says here, V'yesh lamar, da'atel eshmino, da'afu pishlo tziva lehem lichtov, even though he never commanded them to write it down, v'hem katvu, and in the document they write, shit tziva, they told them to write it down, shera. Basically, the document is untrue. They said that he told us to document this, even though he never said that. But nevertheless, v'lo mechsei kishikra, it's not a lie, he says that's the whole point here. Why would he tell the Edim about it? He wants it to be documented. So we're like an Anan Sadeh, or we assume that he wants it documented. And that's the Chiddush over here, that you can document this and say he told you to document it, even though he never said anything of the sort. Because we assume that's what he wants, and that's why he's doing this. The whole point of his Mecha, or his Moda'a, is because he wants this information to be known. If he wants information to be known, of course he would want it documented, because that gives him more proof to the fact that he did or he acted in this manner. So that's a number of chidushim in this Tosfot, very big chidushim in this Tosfot. But this also has impact in other ways, which is there is a machloket between the Ramban and the Rambam and the Sefer HaMitzvot, and that machloket is the status of a shtar. A shtar in general, when Edim sign on a shtar, we say that the shtar is valid, and you can use the shtar in order to collect with the shtar. And we assume, the Gemara says in many places, that when you have Edim sign on the shtar, it's ki'ilu nechrakoa edutan bebeitin. It's as if they came to Beitin and their edut was checked out. So there, the Rambam says, that's all midirabanan. Any shtar that you collect with, any shtar that has tokef to collect with, is always an institution derabanan. Midoraita, the shtar, in a sense, doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a shtar midoraita. The Rabbanan instituted this, shalotinol delet bifnei lavin. In order not to close down the loan market or the credit market, they established that you can have shtarot and you can collect based on shtarot, because otherwise if you have to bring edim every single time to Beit Din in order to collect your money, people wouldn't lend money. It'd be too difficult. Okay, very good. So what you're pointing out, The Ramban points out right away, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Shtarot or Midrabanan? Kiddushin, Kitin. We have all these shtarot that are Doraita. And they are full-fledged documents Doraita, and they have Tokif Midoraita. What are you talking about, the Rambam, that it is Midrabanan? It has to be Midoraita. So seemingly you have a machloket here between the Rambam and the Ramban as to whether documents work Doraita or documents work only Midrabanan. Is a shtar powerful enough to collect Minatorah, or is a shtar only powerful enough to collect Midrabanan? That would seemingly be their machloket. You have the Achronim come and try to, in defense of the Rambam, explain how to differentiate between the cases. You have the Tibbot HaMishpat who does it. Rav Chaim does the same thing. Is why does the Rambam say what he's saying despite the claim of the Ramban? And what you would have to do is say exactly what you were saying, was let's differentiate. There are documents like Gitin and Kiddushin where the document itself has Tokef Midoraita. On the other hand, there are other documents like Shtarot of Mamon or for credit documents that may only be valid Midrabanan, or their machloket between the Rambam and the Ramban, because the Ramban still believes that those have power Midoraita, is about what is the status of that document when you document alone. Does that have a status similar to those of Gitin and Kiddushin, or does it have a different status? And if it has a different status, how do we view that different status? So you have a distinction that is brought. The Tibbot HaMishpat speaks about the difference between what he calls Edei Raya and Edei Kiyum. The difference between whether the Edim are there for proof or the Edim there to give Tokef, legal standing to the document. So again, in Kitin and Kiddushin, he says it's obvious that the Edim are there to give standing to the document. They're giving validity to the document. When you have a get that has Edim signed on it, the Edim are signing to the fact that the husband asked for this to be written. It was written Lishma, and therefore the document is a valid document. They are not testifying about the divorce, because we pass on like Rabbi Lazar, that Edei Mesira Karte, that the only Edei Mesira are the ones who know what had happened. So those that sign on the document, they have no idea whether the divorce went through or not. They're not there to testify about the divorce. They're there to testify about the validity of the document, or in essence, to mikayim the document. And he says the same thing is true by a loan document. And that's how he differentiates the documents from what the Rambam says. How can you have a shtar be valid in Beit Din? That is, mipihem velo miktavam is a problem. And you also have a problem possibly of aid mipi'aid. Both of those who are hearsay or that it's written documentation that's coming to testify in court, neither of those should be valid. That's the Rambam's claim as to why it's invalid. What you have to argue is that the Edim on the Shtar are not there to testify in Beit Din. They're there to testify to the validity of the Shtar, not to the validity of the transaction or to evidence the transaction. The Edim are not acting as Edei Raya in the fact that this transaction took place. They are Edim to the fact that the document itself is a valid document. So that's how he differentiates and says that you could have this klal of mipiyam v'lo miktavam, not hold like the Rabbeinu Tam, that you're allowed to document in writing, and yet still believe that the document is a good document d'oraita, because the Edim that are signing the document are not testifying. They're validating the document. And that is allowed. That's not subject to the regular rules of Edut. That's the way that the Netivot HaMishpat deals with it, or distinguishes and says how you could still believe all these principles are true, and yet have a shtar that is good midoraita. Reb Chaim, on the other hand, makes a distinction about edut in a shtar versus edut in general. The edim in general that are coming to testify, they're coming to testify in court, and therefore they're held to all the protocols of testifying in court. On the other hand, you have Edim that are signed on a shtar. Those Edim, again, are not Edim in the true sense of they are coming to Beit Din and they're doing a Haggadah before Beit Din, because their Edut is done through their signatures on the document itself. And therefore, they're not coming to do a Haggadah. They're not coming to testify in the way that we would normally find Edim coming to testify. They're coming to simply validate a document. And when you validate a document, that type of edut is not subject to all the protocols of Beit Din, because you're not doing it in a way that presents oral testimony. Given that, you have different standards that are applied to a shtar. And in that way, the signatories to a shtar are not subject to all the rules that you have that are normally placed on edim that go before Beit Din. So in summary, Tivlo de Mishpat answers the question by taking away the question. He basically says that edim that are found in a shtar are not edim that are testifying to Haggadah, speaking to Beit Din at all. They're just testifying to the validity of the document, not about the transaction, or not a testimony like regular edim would come and testify. They're simply a de kiyum for the shtar. On the other hand, Reb Chaim believes that edim that are signing on a shtar are a unique form of edut that does work. It works as a Haggadah, but is not subject to all the normal protocols of Beit Din. It's a gzeret ha-katuv that edim on a shtar are able to, in essence, give testimony through their signature. And the way that my brother-in-law said that, Reb Rosenzweig formulated it, was that, in essence, when you sign on the document, you are creating either a blank check, or the Rebbe of Soloveitchik said it is that you have to read between the lines. That the signatures of the edim on such a document is not just to the wording on the document, but is to the entirety of what is represented by this document. And therefore, they're given the power of Haggadah, but not subject to the normal rules of Haggadah. And that is the Gzeret HaKatuv over here. So again, these are very important factors. Because, first of all, they might make a difference as whether a collection through a shtar is d'oraita or d'rabbanan, which is a major machlok between the Rambam and the Ramban. But you have to explain why the Ramban might be right, despite the fact that you have all these problems that Tosafot raised over here. So Tosafot gets out of the problem by saying it's an institution, either Rabbanan. Or the Rabbeinu Tam, who has an even bigger chiddush to say that you're allowed to write your edut down, which goes against what would be the simple reading of the drashat chazal, mipiyam velo mipiktavam. So the Achronim are trying to get around that problem by explaining that Edut on a shtar is different than regular Edut, that you come and testify in Beit Din. By doing that, then you can break it away from the normal principles or normal requirements of Haggadah, of Zchut, all those other things that you need. Those all can be waived here because they're not testifying in the normal sense of testifying. They're either coming to validate the document or their Edut acts differently in this case than normal Haggadah. For that reason, you can waive all of those requirements. Alright, so that's important to all of these cases over here because of the fact that we are allowing you to document something and use that document as a matter of evidence later on. The question is that evidence only derabanan or is that evidence even midoraita? What type of strength does that evidence have when you bring it to court? And what is the right to write something like this or document something like this down? So the Gemara continues now, moda'a bifnei shnayim. Person who wants to declare that his acts were under duress, he has to do it in front of two. And again here, he doesn't have to say to document it. Once again, the Rashbam says the reason he doesn't have to say to document it is because it is zchuto. It's to his zchut to have this documented because he's trying to show that whatever transaction he was involved in was done under duress. And since it was under duress, it's not a valid transaction. There wasn't a valid interaction here because it was done under duress. According to the Balei Tosafot, the chiddush is that he can say, even though they didn't command him or tell him to document it, you could write that he did tell you to document it. For the case of Moda B'Fnei Shnayim, the fact that you have to do this Moda B'Fnei Shnayim again seems to be a reason of two and not three. Which is you don't have to do it in front of Beit Din, you can do it in front of Edim and it suffices. Hoda'a B'Fnei Shnayim v'tzarich lomar k'tovu. So over here, now you have a little change. First of all, hoda'ah. An admission must be in front of two people. This is a very difficult statement because why does an admission have to be in front of two edim? Might be that you need two edim to testify the fact that he admitted, but is his admission not an admission if it's done without two edim? It's done in front of one aid? So again, here, the Raivid, I told you before, says, yes, a hoda'ah is not a legal hoda'ah unless it's done in front of two. That idea that you need two edim to give something legal standing, he makes that same claim over here. The Ramban, on the other hand, who in many places in Shas gives strength to an ed echad, unlike the Balei Tosafot who think that testimony of an ed echad in many places is only midrabanan, the Ramban believes ed echad is midoraita in many places. And so too here, he says, if you do a hodah b'fnei ed echad, it would work. It would only work to the sense that ed echad is enough to make you take a shavuah, and it won't be motzi mamon, but still, a hoda'a b'fnei ed echad is still called a hoda'a. That's still called an admission. Hoda'a b'fnei shnayim is not a requirement for the hoda'a to be valid. It's simply, if you want evidence of the fact that there was a hoda'a, you need two. If you want to be motzi mamon, you want to extract money based on this hodah, then you need two people there to do it. Ve'tzarich lomar k'tovu. And you have to say to document it. Because over here, as the Rishonim point out, it's to his detriment. To have this documented is not helpful for him. And that's for a number of reasons. The first of which is, if you have an oral transaction, even if it's done in front of Edim, then if the debtor comes along and says, Parati, I paid it back, he is Naman, he is believed. Because a person who lends Be'edim does not have to repay Be'edim, does not have to repay back with Edim. Therefore, if he comes and says, Parati, he's believed, and the case is closed. On the other hand, if there's a documented loan, if they write it down, he does not have a right to say parati neged a shtar. Once they show the shtar in Beit Din, his parati no longer carries weight. He needs to bring evidence of the fact that he was porea, that he paid back the loan. Given that, you don't want to document it because it disadvantages the debtor now, where he no longer has a right to say parati. Number two is, when you have an oral loan that is extended, you can only collect from nechassim she'ena mishubadim, nechassim b'nei chorim. You can only collect from unencumbered property. A documented loan gives you the right to collect from encumbered property. Gives you the right to go after nechassim mishubadim because you have a document, a shtar in hand, which has a call, and that gives it, it gives you the ability now to collect from other assets. And number three is, if he repays the loan, and he has no idea that they wrote the shtar, the guy can come and double collect against him. Because he repaid the loan, unbeknownst to him, there was a shtar outstanding, so he didn't ask for the shtar to rip it up. And now all of a sudden the guy creditor shows up with the shtar and says, you never paid me, here's the shtar. The guy's stuck, he has no evidence of the repayment, he had no idea the shtar existed, and now he's going to get double collected against. So writing a shtar, for all of those three reasons, is to his detriment, and therefore we won't let you document the loan in those situations, because the documentation of the loan will hurt the debtor. Kinyan bifnei shnayim. You have to do a kinyan before or in front of two people. Again here, it's a question as to why do you need to do a kinyan in front of two people. The kinyan doesn't exist at all without two people. You can see the Baalei Tosafot are perplexed by that. Omer Rabbeinu Tam. He says that it is considered a kinyan even without two, and that's the view of the majority of the Rishonim over here, is that the two over here are not what give it kiyum, but simply two are the requirement for evidence and not a requirement or basic requirement for the kinyan sudar. And again, the Ravid brings, this gives legal standing to the kinyan because you did it in front of two. Without two people, this kinyan would have no standing. That's a very difficult thing to say, because why can't you have a transaction even though there are no edim there? And here, the Ravid brings, they out like this, suggests that there is no kinyan without edim. In order to make a maisik kinyan into a kinyan, you need edim or edim kiyum to make it into a maisik kinyan. Now, the Rashbam points this out, and nearly all the Rishonim agree to this, is that it's only by kinyan sudar. This is not in all kinyanim. It's particular to kinyan sudar. And you could probably understand that, because a kinyan sudar is not a real kinyan in the sense of transference of ownership. It's a representative kinyan. It's a kinyan that was instituted or is allowed based on the drasha from Megillat Rut that allows for kinyan sudar to take place. That kinyan sudar is a kinyan that represents an exchange of property or assets without ever going through a real exchange of assets. So there you can understand why maybe you need a de kiyum in order to give it tokef. The Ramban and others disagree and say that shnai means just you need two to testify. It doesn't have to be done in front of a Beit Din. It's valid in front of two Edim. But not to say that the Kinyan's invalid if there are no Edim there. So those are the two opinions. But you can understand the view of those that say that Shnayim are required here to give it Kiyum because of the fact that it's a representative Kinyan. Whenever you have something that's representative and it's basically a legal fiction because there's no real transference of assets. It's just the passing of a handkerchief. Why should that have any meaning or legal standing? The answer is, if you make it into something that has a certain amount of ceremony, quote-unquote, to it, that is what gives it standing. So you could argue, no, that just the kinyan itself is what gives it standing. That's the gemira tzadat that you require. Or you could argue that you need edim, ede kiyum, to give the maisa, to give the action, a certain amount of legal standing or heft to it because it's a representative kinyan. And that'll be the view of the Ravid. Although, again, here, the Rabbeinu Tam argues, it's not considered not to be a kinyan when you don't have two. Meaning that it is considered a kinyan even without two, and that's the view of the majority of the Rishonim over here, is that the two over here are not what give it kiyum, but simply two are the requirement for evidence and not a requirement or basic requirement for the kinyan sudar. And then, and he does not have to say document it. Gemara is going to discuss why you're allowed to document such a thing, because over here, there are two parties involved. As soon as you have two parties involved, then the documentation is to the benefit of one party and the detriment of the other party. So over here, why are you allowed to document this without explicit instructions to document the sale, especially from the one who is selling? Why do you have a right to document it without his permission or without him specifically instructing you to do it? Unlike the case of Mecha'ah, or the case maybe of Moda'ah, but we said that it's L'schuto, and you can write it down, maybe even despite the fact that it hurts the other party, that's because over there the Chachamim were empowering those parties to do such a thing. Over here, there's no institution of the Chachamim to say they're empowered to block a chazak or empowered to stop people from doing things under duress. Over here, there's no reason to indicate that, and therefore you'll have to give an explanation as to why you're allowed to document it. V'kiyum shtarot b'shlosha. And so here, this, according to many of the Rishonim, is why you have Shnayim in the other cases, because here, by Kiyum Shtarot, you require three. So the two in the other cases is just in contrast to the three, rather than saying that the two have real meaning in the case, like the Ravid says, well, these are all Eidei Kiyum over here. On the other hand, most of the Rishonim believe, like the Rambam Beinu Tam just said, and the Ramban says in many of these places, the Shnayim are just to the exclusion of three. Eidim work, you don't need a Maaseh Beit in order for this to happen. That's not true by Kiyum Shtarot. The validation of a document requires a Beit Din in order to validate it. And that requires three individuals to do it. The Rashbam points out that the reason for that is because if you have two individuals do it, how are the two individuals who are validating any better than the two Edim that are signed on the document in the first place? And for that reason, he says that even though the Gemara in Sanhedrin brings a memora from Shmuel that says that a Beit Din must be a minimum of three, nevertheless, Shmuel says, imdanu b'shtayim, if two people adjudicated a case and came to a conclusion, dinam din, that the din goes through, it is a proper din, but it's called the Beit Din Chatzuf. It's called the Beit Din that is mechutzaf, that they do it with two and not with three. So that means that you can have a valid Beit Din with two, even though technically the minimum requirement is three. So why don't over here you say the same thing? You can have a validation of the shtar with two, even though normally you need three for a Beit Din. If it's a Maisa Beit Din, two can act in a Maisa Beit Din. Even though they're called a Beit Din Chotzuf, they're still a Beit Din. So the Rashbam points this out, and Bali Tosafot second this, that otherwise you have this problem of two Edim validating what two Edim said. Two Edim validating what two Edim said doesn't do anything more than you had originally. You need a Maisa Beit Din. You need something by which those three Edim now, or Beit Din, are doing something beyond what the first two Edim did. And therefore, we require a full act of Beit Din in order to validate the document. We don't allow two Dayanim to do what the three Dayanim can normally do, even though in other places we might allow the Din to go through in those situations. All right, so that's the Kiyum Shtarot B'Shlosha. Obviously, over here it's Nitan the two Liktov. You can document the item here. That is because every Maisa Beit Din is subject to be written down. Beit Din has the right to take property away from parties or to grant property to other parties. Beit Din always documents things that are to the benefit of one party and to the detriment of other parties. That's why they are the Beit Din. The Rashbam says something interesting here, which I don't think necessarily is necessary to get there. He says that Shukoach Beit Din Yofev Efkeran Hefker. The reason is because Beit Din has the strength to do things because whatever they do to act, Hefker is Hefker. I mean, they can take property away from one party, give it to the other party. So therefore, they can write anything they want down. I would have said, just simply, that is the role of a Beit Din. The role of a Beit Din is to adjudicate between parties, to incriminate one, indict one, exonerate the other, whatever it is that they're doing, and therefore they document it. You don't have to invoke the principle of Hefker, Beit Din, Hefker in order to do that, to say, well, they supersede all legal laws and all ownership. That's not the case. The case is that's what they're empowered to do. So I would have said more simply that they're just empowered to do that. That's why they could document it. The Rashbam says that's not enough. You need Hefker, Beit Din, Hefker to show that I have a right to move property around. Given that, I can document anything I want because I have a right to do that. But that's why this statement you don't see, Ein Tzarech Lomar Ktovu. Because by definition, Beit Din will document that which they have done. All right, so now you have all of these Memrot. Amar Rava, Ikashali, Hakashali. If all of these statements of Rav Nachman One of them bothers me. And that is, Hai Kinyan, Hei Chidami. What exactly is the case of Kinyan over here? Ikemase Beitin, Dami. If the Kinyan Sudar, as we're assuming over here, is the equivalent of Maise Beitin, Libayit Lato. Then you should require three in order to make it a Maise Beitin. Again, if this is an institution, Kinyan Sudar is an institution by which we allowed you through a representative Kinyan to do something, but it has a status like Maise Beitin, why would I want that? Because then I can document it irrespective of whether it's to the benefit or detriment of a party. Over here we said you're allowed to write it without asking permission. So that seems to be like you're acting like a Beitin, and you're writing despite that it's detrimental to one party. So that's why we call it a Maise Beitin. If that's the case, that's what gives you permission to write it. You should also have a requirement of three and not two. As Rashbam says that a kinyan is doma b'din shel dayanim shemotim mizev notim lezeh. Ba'af edi kinyan yedei yududan shroin b'kinyan yotzei mamun zeh b'shat kinyan miyana makneh liyada koneh. That the movement of property from one part to the other is similar to what Beit Din does when it adjudicates a case and moves property from one party to the other. Or the idea that it might be to the detriment of one party, nevertheless, the transaction is still valid, just like a Maise Beit Din is valid, even though it might be dead to the detriment of one of the parties. And therefore, you would consider a Kinyan like a Maise Beit Din. Ilo ke Maise Beit Din, dummy. If you say that this is a transaction between lay parties, and you can do this in front of two edim, amayinu tzrich lomar ktovu, then why doesn't he have to specifically instruct them to write it or document it? Because you don't have a right to document something when it's to the detriment of a party. When you consider it not to be a Maise Beit Din, then basically what we're suggesting is, it's the equivalent, as the Rabbeinu Gershom says here, of a hoda'ah. Bila Maise Beit Din eloka hoda'ah dami amayin tzrich. Then in that case, why don't you need to check if he wants to write it down? Because hoda'ah, we saw before, requires permission to write it down. So if that's the case, why in this case do we not force them to get affirmative permission to document the transaction? I mean, the two statements seem to be mutually exclusive. The requirement for two edim, rather than three as a Beit Din, precludes your ability to document it without permission. Or if you want to document it without permission, that seems to indicate you need three and not two. By the way, that's what most of the Rishonim said over here, that the two is to the exclusion of three. That's what we said before, that many Rishonim believe that two does not mean that you absolutely need two. It simply means you need two instead of three. And you see this in the Gemara now. Gemara is contrasting the possibility of it being a Maise Beit Din versus just a regular Maise between two and three. It's not Mukhach what I'm saying. I think it's just some evidence to that fact. Batar Dibayi, after he asked the question, Hadar Pashto, he answered the question. V'olam lav kemasa Beit Din dummy. It's not classified as an act of Beit Din. V'ocha taimamai. So what's the reason over here that you're allowed to document it? Tein etzarech lamark tovo, that you don't have to instruct in order for it to be documented. V'shtom destam kinyan l'ktiva omeid. A kinyan in general is made to be documented. Now again here, we're not talking about kinyanim in general. We're talking about a kinyan sudar. The reason that is because the kinyan sudar is a representative kinyan. If you really wanted to wait around and you weren't sure about this, you would have waited to do a real kinyan. You would have gone and waited for a kinyan mishicha. You would have waited to go and establish a chazaka on the property. You would have done the real maisa kinyan. The reason that you're doing a kinyan sudar is because you want to accelerate the transaction. It's a way to expedite the transaction and finalize the transaction immediately. If you're trying to expedite and finalize the transaction, a part and parcel of that would be to document the transaction. You must want the transaction because you're willing to accelerate it. If you didn't want the transaction, you could have said, wait until we make a kinyan on it. And that would have deferred or given you the time to decide whether you wanted to go through with it or not. The fact that you entered into the transaction in this expedited manner shows that you must really want it. So implicit in the expediting of the transaction is claim to documentation. And that's why over here you're allowed to document, even though it may not be to the benefit of that party. Because there's an implicit permission that is granted because of the speed that shows that he must want the transaction to go through. Tosfot over here says, you have a right to declare that you don't want to document it. I mean that it is implicit that you are allowing for documentation, but if you explicitly say, I don't want it documented, you have a right to stop them from documenting it. So that's lachzorbo. You can't be chozer in the kinyan, but you can be chozer in the implicitly granted right to document this. So that's what the Baalei Tosafot would say over here. That's what you learn from this, because the assumption is stam kinyan l'ktiva omei. If you declare otherwise, then you have a right to declare such. Rabbi Rabbi Yosef, Damrei Tavayu, lo kadvin in moda'ah, elaman delo tzayit dino. We only write a moda'ah for someone who doesn't listen to the court. It's an individual who, in general, is held in contempt of court, or has been in contempt of court, and therefore you have no legal redress. Since you have no legal redress through the court system, we write you a moda'ah in order to protect you in the future. Remember that a moda'ah is stating that something was done under duress. By declaring it was done under duress, you're invalidating some documentation or something that happened. So that's an important distinction here, because a micha'ah, an objection, is after the fact. An objection comes to undermine a chazak, or after there is supposedly was a transaction between you, you object. A moda'ah must be before kinyan that takes place. You can't come after you were entered into a kinyan and say it was done under duress. Because then everybody would do that. After the fact, everybody would come along and say, you know what, I changed my mind. Well, how do I change my mind? I was under duress then. So that we don't allow. You have to declare the duress before you enter into the transaction. What Rabbah and Rabbi Yosef are saying is, we're only going to grant you that right of documenting the fact that it was under duress if you declare it before the transaction went through and you have no redress in Beit Din. If you can go to Beit Din and take care of the issue, then go to Beit Din and go to the tell them about it. Why are you coming to us to document the fact that it was under duress? Go to Beit Din and tell them that it was done under duress and take your case to court and then have them adjudicate the case. Don't document it. Bring a deem to that fact. Once you bring a deem, the court will take the property from the other party and give it back to you. So what Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef are saying, that this is only a mechanism for recourse when the individual who's your counterparty over here, is unwilling to listen to Beit Din, or will not listen to Beit Din, or has a history of not listening to Beit Din. Over here, the Baalei Tosafot asks, what this moda'ah is about? What is this letter of duress about? Because we're going to see in the Amud Bet that the Gemara limits the cases or situations in which you can use a moda'ah. And Tosafot leaves it as a tema, as to what exactly is the case, a tema moda'ah demai. What is the situation and what is the case? The Ramban suggests that even in the cases that we're going to see on the Amud Bet, where people know that there's duress, and you're allowed to write a moda'ah, even in those cases, you're not permitted to use the moda'ah as the vehicle for undermining the transaction if you have a path to redress through going to the court system. Or in other words, what we're trying to do is limit the use of these letters of duress because they are very risky, because we don't want them showing up and undermining all sorts of transactions. So when you have redress through the courts, we much prefer you go that direction rather than use a letter of duress. Even about me and you, we can write it. Now what they're saying is that this has nothing to do with trustworthiness. This has nothing to do with whether you're going to listen in court or not. It has to do with the right that is granted to a party to declare something that is under duress. As the Ashram notes over here, because sometimes a Beit Din is just not available to deal with your issue, whether it doesn't have time on its docket or you're in a place where there is no Beit Din. And so that person wants to make sure that they're protected. It has nothing to do with whether the person does or does not listen to the court. It is that the fact that the person wants protection even when there is redress through the courts, because the courts are not always available to take care of him or take care of this situation. Or, in essence, it's a very subjective manner. Whether a person listens to the court or doesn't listen to the court, you'll never know beforehand. You only know that after the fact. So in order to protect himself, the person wants a moda'ah because there's a possibility the courts won't be able to help him in the future. Amrei Naradai. Now the Naradai had another qualification. Kol moda'ah. Delokti ba anan yadina bei beunsa deplanya la moda'ahi. If a moda'ah is written without stating what the duress was or explicitly acknowledging that they know what the duress is, that is not called a moda'ah. That's not considered to be a declaration of under duress. Right, so what the problem is, and this is the issue that we're trying to prevent, is seller's remorse. Which is that anytime someone sells something and then they have seller's remorse, after the fact, they can go in and say, I was done under duress, or I'm going to do it under duress. He can put in a form of protection in order to stop the transaction coming through, or he can pull it out later. So what we want to know is, what was the duress? Because if he doesn't tell us what the duress is, he could be making it up, and he could be using this as a protection so that if he decides later on he didn't really want to sell it, he'll pull out the moda'ah. So now he has like an ace up his sleeve, which is he can always now cancel the contract because he has this documented. So what we want to do is we want to know that they know the evidence of the duress, and they're aware of the duress. Given that, then you can write it down or document it. The Gemara wants to know, Moda Adamai, what is this declaration about that we require you to know what the duress is? Idigita umatanto, if it's talking about a divorce, a bill of divorce, or a documentation of a gift, gluya milta ba'almahi, all we need to know is some declaration of onus, because this is something that is done willingly by a party. These are unilateral actions. A get is a unilateral action by the Baal towards the wife. A matana is a unilateral action to grant someone something. There aren't two parties in these cases. If you're taking unilateral action, if you didn't want to do it, you simply don't have to do it. So when he declares he's under duress, we're going to believe him, because if he wasn't under duress, just don't do it. So the fact that he's doing it and declaring that he's under duress will give him a certain amount of believability or nemanut. Because, again, since it's done of his own volition, he could just not do it. The fact that he is doing it, now he can ask for help to say that it was done under duress. Or in essence, what he's saying is, we just need you to have some sort of information. We need a declaration of sorts, we don't need details. And that's what is being said here. This can't be what the Nardai is speaking about, because over here you don't need that type of detail. So the Rashbam says, through that Migo, he gets an underlying believability in the Modah. But if we find out afterwards that the Modah was a lie, it would be considered to be invalid. Though there are many Rishonim, including the Ramah, the Rambam, and many others that believe that even if he lies and the Modah is not valid, it's still valid in this case. Because all he needs is to show that he didn't do the Kinyan or he didn't do this action with a Leib Shalem. And so whether it's a lie or not a lie is irrelevant to us. It just means that we need him to declare beforehand that that wasn't his intent to fully go through with this transaction. And therefore, it would work, even if it's not true, the Modah, the fact that there is a Modah is enough to invalidate that transaction. Edith Zvine, if we're talking about a transaction, Vamarova Lukadvina Modah Zvine. He says we never write a Modah about a transaction, because the Rashbam over here says, nearly time in the Rova, what's Rava's reasoning for the fact that you could never have a transaction under duress? Mishum Damrina the Kaman Bepirkin. I'm going to say later on in the Perek, we also had this earlier as well. Hilchata, the loche is Talyua. They hung him up, they string him up on a tree. Vizavin, and he agrees to make the sale because he was strung up on a tree. Zvine, zvine. The transaction goes through. That the transaction is considered to be a valid transaction, even though he was pressured into the transaction. The Balei Tosafot, when we discussed this, we discussed that there are different levels of duress and different levels of acquiescence in these situations. As the Rashbam notes over here, that there's a difference in how this transaction was carried out. Rava's din later on, that if you string him up and he agrees to the sale, if he agrees to the sale and then goes picks which property he wants to sell, then we consider that to be that he sold it willingly, because he went ahead and decided which property. He was a party, in a sense, to the transaction. On the other hand, if they demanded a particular property and he sold it to them, then the sale's invalid, because that is considered to be under duress. And therefore, you would automatically get an out from it. You wouldn't need a moda'ah for that, because they demanded and forced you to sell a particular property. So what the Rashbam points out is that Rava's din later on, in and of itself, obviates the need for a moda'ah. Either you're not allowed to use a moda'ah because you chose the property and you were doing it willingly in the end, or you don't need a moda'ah because the transaction is invalid when they force you to sell a particular property. So given Rava's opinion later on, you don't need a moda'ah at all. What's the point of a moda'ah by a transaction? Whereas other Rishonim just believe that Rava's statement later on proves that a sale under duress is a sale. And given that, moda'ah has no place here when you have a sale that is under duress, because duress is not an excuse for backing out of a sale. So since he's getting monetary remuneration for the property, we assume in the end that he's really doing it not under duress. Because we have a principle that the Gemara announced before, that nobody sells land unless they're really under duress for money or for cash. And so every sale in some sense is a sale under duress. And therefore, we don't consider duress to be an issue in sales. So whether it's because he's receiving cash in return, or because all sales have a side of duress to them, that's why Rova believes that you can't have a moda'ah with regards to a sale. given the fact that a transaction under duress in the end is considered to be a valid transaction, then it says over here, why would we ever write a modah? Why would we ever allow you to write a document that says the transaction was done under duress? Because duress is not a reason to undermine the transaction. It's not a valid way to undermine the transaction. So given that, why would you allow a document of duress to be written? Right, so now the Gemara says, L'olam disvine. No, we're talking about a transaction. Modi Rava, hechi de'anis, ukemasin de pardesa. Rava does admit, in certain situations, that duress is a reason to undermine or undo a transaction. And that is where the individual is pressed into a corner and has no choice. For instance, this individual gave over his vineyard as collateral for the loan that he took out for 3 years. After the 3 years where the creditor had used the land over those 3 years, Amar, this is what the creditor says to him. If you sell me the land now, good, everything's fine. Ve'ilo, if not, kavishna l'shtar mashkanta, I'm going to hide or rip up the shtar that this was collateral. Vamina l'kucha hi biyadi, and I'm going to say that I purchased it because I can make that claim. You have no evidence to the contrary. I've been here 3 years. I don't have to show a shtar. I get the property. Ki agavna kadvin moda. In that case, we do write a moda, because basically, in a sense, he's blackmailing him and saying that either you sell it to me, or I'm going to confiscate the whole property by saying it was mine, I'll get it for free. So that type of duress is a duress where the guy is left in a legal bind, which is that he really has no choice. He must sell it because of the claim that the party has that will take it away from him for free. So since he has no other choice but to sell it over here, then we will allow you to, in this instance, write a moda'ah or indicate that you're not willing to sell it here and you're only doing it because of the threat that he has made against you. So now, here the Rashbam quotes Rabbeinu Chananel and says, how do we know that there was duress over here? How are the Edim going to know that the guy threatened him? He's not going to say this in front of someone else. He's not coming to Beit Din and saying, L'kuchai b'yadi, I'm threatening that it's L'kuchai b'yadi, then he won't have a claim. His claim only works because he does it quietly, and then he'll go and lie and say that he bought it. So how are we going to have Edim to the fact this was done under duress? The Nadai are saying you need to know the onus. You need to know what type of pressure was put on it. How are the Edim ever going to know that? Because this guy's never going to allow anybody else to know it because this is his trump card that he can say, I bought it. So he's not going to allow anybody else to know that information because if they know he's lying, then it's not a claim anymore. So here the Rabbeinu Chananel says, Eich yadu Edim bonus shel bala pardes. Dim ifnei Edim amar lo makzik tanot lekaman in tzrich moda. Ayidu sheshamu. Then the Edim can testify to it. You don't need anything to be written. The Edim know, and they can testify in court. So he says, "Bekach perish." This is how he explains it. So what the Rabbeinu Chananel says is the situation is a case where the individual comes with Edim, and the guy says, "Yeah, I bought it from you 3 years ago, and it's mine. I don't need to show any documentation. I've been there the years of Chazaka." Afterwards, the debtor goes to him and says, "I'm going to sell you the property, and I'm going to document the sale because you're allowed to document something without the buyer being present." Because the mocher is the one who is at risk, or the one who's to whose detriment it is. Therefore, you can document it. So he gets it, drawn up the document, he brings it to the Edim and says to them, listen, I'm about to sell this property with this document, but you know that he made a claim that he bought it 3 years ago. And then he takes the document over to the guy and collects his money, and now he has proof or evidence of the fact that it was done under duress. And so that's how the Rabbeinu Chananel says they set up the situation so that he has a way to prove that it's done under duress. So in that case, where he's going to lose everything, if he doesn't sell it, then Rova agrees that you can write a moda. So what it seems according to the Rashbam is there's a difference between whether somebody sells under duress, but the duress is just to force the sale, not that if he doesn't sell it, they'll steal the property. They're just trying to press him into the sale. Over here, his only other choice is he'll lose the field unless he sells it. That type of choice, where you have a choice between losing everything and selling it, that's a case where we're writing moda'ah, we're allowed for a letter of duress to be drawn up, even though we don't allow it usually by transactions because we're afraid of people abusing that right in sales. But here, you are granted that right, and that's what the Nardai were speaking about, and that's where Rava would also permit such a moda'ah to be written. Amar Rav Yehuda, hai matanta tamirta lo magvinimba. If you have a document of a gift that was done. Tamirta means in hiding or privately. We'll see in a second. The Gemara will ask what that means. Lo magvinimba, you're not allowed to collect a gift based on that document. Heichi dami matanta tamirta. What exactly is a matanta tamirta? Rav Yosef, damarlo lesade, he says to witnesses, zilu atmuru, go and hide, v'katvule, and write down this document that says I'm gifting the property to so-and-so. V'ikadamre, and there's some that say, Rav Yosef, delo amarlohu, titvu b'shuko b'braita, v'tichtvule. That rather than formulate it in the positive form of saying, go and hide, or do this in private, he does not tell them to go do this in public. So the two different lashonot of Rav Yosef, one lashon of Rav Yosef is, it's considered to be a hidden document or a questionable document when he tells them to go do this in hiding. Don't let anybody see you document this. The other view is that when he doesn't say anything to them, if he doesn't tell them go do this in public and make it clear that everyone, that you're doing this, then that's considered to be a matanta tamirta because he's not granting them the right to publicize that which he is doing. That's the girsa that we have according to the Rashbam. The Rashbam does bring an alternate girsa from Rabbeinu Chananel, which the Balei Tosafot also bring, which is the Amar Lehu, lo titvu b'shuku bara, that he does instruct them not to sit out in a public place. In the first case, he said to them, go do it in private, actively. Over here, he doesn't say it actively, do it in private, but he does tell them not to go and do it in public, as opposed to the way that the Rashbam reads it, which is, he did not instruct them to go out and do it in public. So the question is, do you need positive affirmation of going out and do it in public? Or do you need him to deny the Edim the right to go write it in that manner? So the Rabbeinu Chananel says he needs to deny them going out in public and writing it. Whereas the Rashbam says you need positive affirmation of the fact that you want them to write it out in public. Based on that, the Balei Tosafot note that there'll be a difference today where we write it in the document, seemingly is supportive of the girsa that we have and that of the Rashbam. Rabbeinu Chananel, you have to say, even though you don't have to say it, it's a way to make the document foolproof or even better, a cleaner document by saying that he instructed them to do it out in public, even though that's not necessary according to this lashon of the Rabbeinu Chananel. My benayu, what's the nafkamin between them? Ik benayu stama. The difference between them is if he says nothing. Obviously, when he says nothing, according to the one that you need affirmation of the fact that he's trying to hide it, then this would not be considered to be hiding, because he just says, go sign it. Doesn't tell him to go make sure it's private. The other hand, for the one who says that he has to specifically state that it is public, and I want it to be public, then stam would also be a problem of matanta tamirta. Now, what you're saying is possibly there are reasons to hide it. The reasons are usually problematic, and that's why the Gemara doesn't want this. Sometimes there are justifications for wanting to be hidden, the gift, but in most cases, the hidden gift is a way to subterfuge because he wants to block another transaction. There are times where you may be justified, say you want to give a gift to one person, not offend another person. So you could supposedly justify doing it privately. Nevertheless, in most cases, when you have a situation where you're trying to do this undercover, it's usually subterfuge or it's to the detriment of some other party. And that's why we're not going to allow this contract to be utilized or valid. Amarova, Vavi Modala Chaverta. Rava then says something which is difficult, which is, says, yes, it's not a valid matana that the individual can go and come and collect the gift. On the other hand, it serves as an undermining of other contracts. It shows that this person, when he contracted afterwards, was doing it under duress, or the equivalent of doing it under duress, and that's why he gave it to this party first, to block future transactions. Amra Bappa, had the Rava lab befeirush itmar. This statement of Rava was not said explicitly, ela michlola itmar. It was an inference from another statement, and that is wrong. That's what Rav Papa is going to say in the end, that the inference drawn, or the conclusion drawn from what they saw from Rava was incorrect. Da'u gavra, da'azal l'gdushe yitita. There was this individual who wanted to marry a certain woman. Amrolei, ikavta avli kulu nechsech. If you grant me all of your possessions, all of your assets you give to me, havinamach, I'll marry you. So she was making a steep claim for the marriage, and saying that the only way she's going to marry him is if he gives over all of his assets, writes all of his assets to her. V'ilo, lo avinolach, if you don't do that, I won't marry you. Azo katve lo, l'kulu nechsai. He went ahead and gave or granted all of his possessions to this woman. Obviously, he wanted to marry her pretty badly. And therefore, he grants all of his assets to her in order to marry her. Atze brei kashisha. His oldest son comes and says to him, Amalei, v'au gavra mate avi alei. What's going to happen to me? You just basically disinherited me from all the property of the family. You just gave all this property to this woman, and I'm going to get nothing now. Amar lo, the sade, he said to witnesses, Zilu itamro be'ever yamina, go over to that right corner over there, or that side over there. Whether that just means over there, or it means in a location called Ever Yamina, possibly using the word Yamina like it's used in Tanakh to mean the south. So go over to the southern side of the city, of the location, and sign it over there. In essence, he's saying, go do it in a private, quiet location. V'katvulei, and write to my son all of the property. Grant him all the property. In essence, what he did was, he preemptively gave all the property to his son, before he wrote the property or gave it to his wife. After the Kamei Rava. So now the case came before Rava. Amar lo, lo markana, velo markana. Nobody has an acquisition over here. Meaning that neither the woman gets a kinyan, nor does the child get a kinyan. Neither of these are valid contracts. Mandu chozo savar, the one who witnessed this event, thought, Bishum davi amod ala chaverta. What's the reason that this is considered to be invalid in both cases? Now, the case of the contract where he told him to go hide on the side and write it, we already said that if you tell someone to document a gift privately and quietly like that, it's not a good gift. So we understand why the son has no rights to this property. But why does the woman that he married not have rights to this? He did that openly, and that was a clear gift. The answer seemingly is that the document of sale to the son, even though he can't collect with it, acts as a moda, acts as a declaration that the transaction afterwards was invalid. That's what it looks like. Velohi, that is not the case. That's not the reason Rava passed in that way, and therefore it's the wrong conclusion. Hatam mukha milta. Over there, the overwhelming evidence makes it obvious. The machman unsu the katavla. That he only wrote her or granted her all of his assets under duress. It's obvious from any party that's there. You don't need him to declare it. It's clear that he's giving all his assets because this woman put him in a corner and would only marry him if he gave over all of his assets. Of a hacha. Mar nechale lelikne, omar lo nechale lelikne. Over here, that's not the case. And over here, the person wants to grant a gift to one party. He doesn't want to grant the gift to the other party. And so, he has one document that he does quietly and privately, which is not a real document. And he has another one where he does a full-fledged documentation. And so the first document which he does privately is not going to undermine the document that he did publicly, where he gifts to two parties. He made it look good. He wanted the person to think he was gifting it to him, so he had him write it in private. But once he does that, it's an invalid contract, so the matana doesn't go through. Not only is it an invalid contract, it's not good enough to block a future gift. Because we assume that he decided he wanted to give it to this party, he didn't want to give it to that party, and he's making a decision. He's not under obvious duress when he gifts to the second party. Given that, then the first one is not a moda'ah. Other than in the case with the son and the wife, it was clear that he did not want to give this to this woman. He was only doing it because that was the only way he could marry her, but he didn't really want to give it. And therefore, when he gave it to his son, he was clearly trying to block the gift to his wife. So in that case, the document works as a moda'ah because it's so obvious that that's what he was trying to do. That he was trying to block the gift of the assets to his future wife or fiance. So either you say that the document of gift to his son was the mechanism for making this into a moda'ah, or making it obvious that he was under duress. Or, you could even suggest here that the duress is so obvious that the second document doesn't even need it. It's clear that he only did this in order to marry her, he didn't really want to gift her the property. And so the duress is so obvious, you don't even need a moda'ah in this case. But in a case where it's not mukhkam milta, where it's not obvious what his intentions are, there the invalid document will not act like a moda'ah. Just note, the Rabbeinu Gershom over here suggests that it's not the first document that is the Temirta and the one that is considered the Moda, but the second document. And he says here, Va'adar Alta Matana Atzma Katva La'acher B'Temirta. He writes the second gift in private, not the first time. The way that we've described it until now was that the first gift was the private one, and then he sold it afterwards, or he gifted it afterwards. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom says is that, no, he gifted it at first in public, and then he made a second gift in private. And is that second document the equivalent of a moda'ah for the first document? Because otherwise, why would he gift it if he already gifted it to someone else? It must be that he's trying to indicate that he was under duress in the first gift. Like this incident over here, where he claims that the incident was that he married the woman and granted her the possessions, and then wrote privately to his son after the fact, that the possession should be granted to him. And it was the second document we're asking whether that is considered to be a declaration of duress. Ibailo stamamai. It asks the question, stam, what is the din? Ravina amar lo cheshinan, Ravashi amar cheshinan. Ravina says we don't worry about it. Ravashi says we do worry about it. V'hilchaton alocha is cheshinan. So over here, it's not clear what the Gemara is asking. Stam amai. What does stam mean? So the Rashbam brings an interpretation which he favors, which is, it's going back to the case of Rav Yosef. But Rav Yosef, we had the nafka meaning between the two lishonot of Rav Yosef was stama. When you just gave the document to be written, but you didn't specifically state to hide, and you didn't specifically state to do it out in public. What's the din there? Well, that depends on the two lishonot of Rav Yosef. And that's a machloket. Ravina amar lo cheshinan. We don't worry about this being a tmira, so therefore we subscribe to the first lashon of Rav Yosef and not the second lashon. Rav Ashi amar cheshinan. Rav Ashi says we do worry about that second lashon of Rav Yosef. The hilchata and halacha is that we do worry about it. You have a safek over here. And therefore we're not going to collect with such a document. And that's why you have to now, when you document a gift, v'kach amar lanu, katvua b'shuka v'chatmua b'bara. It becomes a standard legal language that must be put into every document now. That's what the Rashbam is pointing out, that you have to write in the document, and it's like legal language that goes into other documents, that the he told us to write it in public and to display it, that language is required. Even though he declares to them or tells them to just write it, that coming with writing or documenting something is, we assume he wants it documented the way the Chachamim made it valid. So therefore you document it in a way that says, like that Lashon of Rabbi Yosef, that says we declare that it is a public type of declaration or documentation. So even though he doesn't specifically say that, we assume that when he wants it documented, he wants it documented properly. And therefore, in the contract, you will write this language to avoid all problems. In addition to that, the Rashbam and the Balei Tosfot mention that they had a practice in many places that before they signed a document, whether that was a document of marriage or that was a document of sale, that they would say in the documentation, there would be legal language that said that they are mevato kol moda'a, deidlu, that any moda'a, any declaration of duress is erased or not valid against this contract. So they used to draw up the contracts with the language in it that would block the ability for documents of duress to come and undermine the transaction. It's similar to language that is used today in contracts, which say that any outside agreements, oral agreements outside of this contract are invalid, because all of the terms of the transaction are documented here within this contract, and there's no other documentation, no other agreements that will affect it. So that's basically what you're saying, that you're mevatel any moda, you're mevatel any other declarations of duress, so that the document can go through. The difficulty with that is now you prevent people who are really under duress from protecting themselves, because every document now says, like Kol Nidre on Yom Kippurim, any nether that I'm going to take is invalid in the future. So same thing here. Any moda'a that you're going to bring before us is invalid. And that's what they put into the contracts or into the documents of the Gitin and so on and so forth to prevent people from declaring duress after the fact. Obviously it's done protect from people trying to undermine or walk back transactions. But nevertheless, it does have a cost to it, which is the fact that now people who really are under duress have a much harder time protecting themselves. The Rashbam brings a second view, which is, that it's going on a declaration of duress. That which we just said before, in Rava's position, that a document that is done, Matanat Tamirta, still acts as a moda'a to another document of a stama mi'avi moda'a. But is a stam document considered to be a moda'a? Veloni ira klau, he says, I don't think that's the question here. Dalau lishna darmin in stama psula, vadai lo avi moda'a, dainu tamirta. He says, because the answer to that question is obvious. If you think that the document is invalid, then you also think it's not a moda'a. If you think the document is valid, then obviously it is a moda'a because it is a valid document. And you take the gift, forget about the moda'a, you already gifted it to a party. So he says that question is not a valid question to say, oh, when they signed it stam, and you consider it to be an invalid document, is it still a moda'a? Well, if you think it's a matana tamirta, then a matanat zemirta is not a valid document. It's also not a valid declaration of duress. The answer to that question is obvious, and therefore you don't need to ask that question. That's why the Rashbam rejects that understanding of the reading in the Gemara and favors that this is going back to the Lishonot of Rabbi Yosef to understand which of the two Lishonot do we subscribe to. But the question does make sense according to the Girsa of the Rabbeinu Chananel, and that's why this is the version of the Rabbeinu Chananel, because Rabbeinu Chananel said the two statements of Rabbi Yosef before, one was saying, don't do it in hiding, and the other one was saying, don't do it in public. So what happens if he makes no declaration? What is the story with that position? And that's the nature of the question over here, because it's not covered by the statements of Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef's two statements, according to Rabbeinu Chananel, one was a positive statement saying, do it in private. The other statement was, just don't do it in public. What happens if he doesn't say anything? Does his not say anything then cause us a problem? Or does he have to make a declaration specifically stating that he wants it done in public? So for the Rabbeinu Chananel, that question is a relevant question. For the Rashbam, that's not a relevant question, because his Girsa already has a side of Rabbi Yosef that already thinks that that is a matanta tamirta. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Mem Aleph, Amud Aleph.